This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Andrew Koh, the author of Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Very glad to talk to you about this book. I love the title. You know, caught my attention right away. It also kind of has signification, I know, for the book, and we'll talk about that. But when you say a cultural history of Chinese food in the United States, what was your intent with this book?
My intent was to explore the American experience of Chinese food, and not just Chinese food in the United States, but what Americans encountered in China when they first arrived back in 1784. And to follow this trail all the way up to the present and to figure out, why do we eat the Chinese food that we eat here in the United States?
And by which you mean the version of Chinese food that we eat. I mean, obviously, there are many different forms of Chinese food, and you talk about that in the book considerably. There's regional cuisines. And as you talk about the history, you know, going back to the 1780s, I thought that was very evocative, this sort of sense of otherness that the Westerners came to China with, as they did, a kind of Eurocentric, American-centric version of their world. Instead of going to China and saying, well, look, what is this interesting place with different customs than our own, they went and said, who are these people? You know, they're heathens. They eat dogs and cats. What is going on here? And that has sort of suffused the history of Chinese food from the very beginning, as our attitudes toward China and the Chinese people are suffused by these Eurocentric versions of their reality. But maybe you could, you know, walk through it a little bit here, because it's an entire book. We won't be able to cover everything.
Right. Well, when the Americans first arrived in China in 1784, the Americans were traders who were trying to open up trade with the Chinese emperor. And when they arrived in China, for them it was kind of arriving on Mars. This was the most alien environment they'd ever been, with customs that were utterly strange, including culinary customs. They ate with sticks. They ate things like birds' nests and shark's fins, which was just weird. But they also ate disgusting food, things like dogs, cats, and rats.
Sea cucumbers.
Those ooey, disgusting, slimy things called sea cucumbers. And at that time, in the beginning, it was just the most exotic cuisine on earth. They'd never seen anything weirder before. But as the Americans sort of stuck around in China and had more experience with trade in China, they began to get kind of turned against Chinese food.
Right, and you talked a lot at the beginning of the book about the different visitors to China. There were two moments that I sort of picked up on. One was in the 1780s, when America was brand new, and then later, I think it was in the 1840s. Was it Caleb Cushing? Do I have that?
Well,
right?
That was Caleb Cushing was the first American diplomat,
right?
But he was the other big group of Americans in China were missionaries. And they came in beginning in the 1820s and 1830s, and they were going to, you know, China was the largest nation on earth, the most populous nation, but it was also heathen. There were no Christians there, and they wanted to convert them to Christianity. And they came to China, they settled in Guangzhou, and began to, like, try to talk to the Chinese, and they were shocked to find that the Chinese weren't interested, and that the Christian... Christianity had no interest to them. And they began to become embittered by this experience. And they had a kind of their reaction also turned them against Chinese food.
Right. And when they came back one of the things you talked about is the missionaries come back from China, write books about being there, their experiences, how difficult it was. And there's a little bit of talk about the food. So this is sort of the beginning of putting into the American consciousness the idea of Chinese food. And it was alien, unpleasant, weird, you know, all these tastes that they couldn't understand. Now then what happened after that was Chinese people began to come to the United States, which you show as in the beginning in the 1840s for the gold rush in California.
Right. What happened was is that in 1849, Chinese arrived in San Francisco as treasure seekers. They were trying to make a fortune in the California gold rush, not just as miners, but by opening stores and also restaurants. And these were the first Chinese restaurants in the United States. They served a kind of mixed menu, half Chinese, half Western, because most of these Chinese knew Westerners quite well from Hong Kong, Guangzhou, other parts of South China. So they knew what the Western tastes were. And the Chinese side of the menu was simply for their own countrymen.
So the menus would be in Chinese for the Chinese eaters, and in American and in English would be the other menu that they expected Americans would only order from there.
Well, we assume so, but we've never actually seen a menu from 1849 San Francisco. They don't exist, I believe. But we know from travelers' accounts that they had these dual menu, that they had these like two sides of the kind of food that they served. And at first, the Westerners were like, you know, sort of amazed and interested by this exotic cuisine, and they sampled, you know, what they called the curries, hashes, and fricassees of the Chinese food. And at first, you know, that was kind of, you know, it was kind of an adventurous thing to do. But then, after a couple of years, they began to turn against the Chinese, and they also began to turn against Chinese food.
And so. Well, you talk about that, you know, at length in the book, which is the sort of sense that Chinese immigrants, you know, because they were different, and there was a certain amount of racism in American culture in the 19th century toward others. So there's that going on, but also there was simply the competition for jobs. That, you know, as all immigrants, succeeding waves of immigrants to America have faced that. Resentment from the people who were here before them competing for jobs. But the Chinese had the extra issue of being different.
Right. In California during the 1850s and 1860s, you know, we have to remember that California was a very new state and a very underpopulated state and essentially a very un-American state at the beginning because it had been part of Mexico before. So Americans, white Americans, were a little bit insecure, and they were very worried about economic competition from miners from other parts of the world, from Mexicans, French, South Americans, and also Chinese. And they kicked out the French and the South Americans and didn't treat the Indians very well at all. But the Chinese kept coming and coming. And by the thousands every year, and the mining districts were filling up with Chinese. The cities were filling up with Chinese. Lots of the jobs in things like cigar making and the laundry work, and other industries were being given to Chinese. And the white Americans just said, "We don't want these people here anymore." And they began to campaign against them,
which then then eventually led to laws forbidding Chinese to immigrate to America.
Right. I mean, anything Chinese became anathema, and that included Chinese food. In 1882, they passed this incredible Immigration Act against the Chinese, which essentially made it impossible for Chinese to immigrate, for Chinese to become citizens. And that was kind of like, you know, closed the door on Chinese, you know, for almost a century.
Right. It's it is amazing to think of that. I mean, we do have restrictions today on immigration, and there's immigration today is actually the crux of a lot of racist discussion as well, and economic discussion. But the idea of saying that a group of people could not become citizens is just amazing. But of course, the way we were treating Indians at that time and the way we were treating anybody who was different was pretty extreme. So what you document is that mostly at that point Chinese were in California, but later, you know, as we get into the 20th century, there's more immigration of Chinese people to other parts of America, kind of spreading east from California. And you get these little pockets of Chinatowns and Chinese culture in different parts of America. So you have a beginning of awareness of Chinese food and Chinese people in other parts of the country, although always kind of put into a narrow space, I think. And then one of the things, I mean, I know I'm jumping ahead, but one of the scenes you have I thought was great, which was a, I think it was in Minnesota, in a small town in Minnesota, a housewife in the 50s serving Chinese food as a kind of exotic.
Well, that's from Sinclair Lewis's Main Street. And it's Sauk, it's his fictional town of Sauk Center, Minnesota. The lead character wants to she's like a girl from the city who's married a country doctor, I think it was.
So it's not the 50s.
No, it's the 1920s. Yeah. And she wants to show the townspeople, the sort of upper crust of this little town, what a sophisticated entertainment in the city is. And you know what a dinner party would be, and she invites. So they all come over to dinner, and they have to play these like weird games and dress up in costumes, and then they have to eat chow mein, and everybody is kind of like, you know, this is just too weird for them, and chow mein wasn't served in Sauk City, Minnesota after that.
Right. Well, and it's sort of you also talk about chop suey at length, which was. I guess that was something new to me. I had not recognized how chop suey had become a sort of cultural icon, a signifier for a certain kind of food. It became popular. And then there's this whole issue of, you know, sort of like pizza. Is it American or is it really Chinese? And actually, as you document, chop suey is a Chinese dish, but probably very different in China than it was in the United States.
Right. Well, to backtrack a bit, the Chinese fled from California, fleeing, you know, racial violence, and they began to settle in places like New York, Boston, and Washington, and they, you know, formed the first Chinatowns there. And in the mid-1880s, a group of adventurous New York writers and artists who called themselves Bohemians began to, like, nose around the immigrant districts looking for like weird exotic culinary experiences. And they discovered these restaurants on Mott Street in Chinatown serving Chinese food. And unlike the San Francisco whites, they were like really interested by this and they wanted to experience. And they went in there and ordered dishes, including a dish called chow chop suey. And for them, it was tasty, cheap, and filling. This was like good food to them, but it was also exotic food. And the chop suey craze began then. And from Chinatown, first chop suey began to draw people to Chinatown. And then chop suey restaurants began to open outside of Chinatowns you know, open in other parts of the city and then to spread around the nation. Chinese restaurants were a good money-making opportunity for immigrants. And the chop suey, and Americans had like an unquenchable thirst for chop suey. And by 1910, there were probably chop suey restaurants in every large city and most towns in the United States.
And chop suey at that point was, it was still a stir fry, I assume, but it was a kind of mixture of, it had, I know, celery. I mean, there were certain things that were in it.
The basic ingredients of chop suey as it became was celery, onions, bean sprouts, maybe some water chestnuts, maybe some kind of chopped green vegetable, and then like something like a chicken or pork.
And a brown sauce.
Whitish brown sauce.
Right.
And this was different from the original version of the dish, which was kind of like a funky, earthy stew with like weird dried seafood and right. other strange,
tree ear mushrooms.
Yeah, tree ear mushrooms and things like that, which was weird to Americans, but also had meats in it, like chicken giblets and things like that, what Americans didn't really recognize. And in Chinese restaurants, if they didn't recognize the meats, they were afraid it might be dog meat or cat meat. And so they wanted to say, that's pork, that's chicken. They wanted to be, if they couldn't recognize it, they wouldn't eat it.
Right, and so the theme there, I think, is that the Chinese restaurant owners attempting to give Americans what they think Americans want, and probably guessing correctly, kind of, and think about this as almost a model of what customer-driven business would look like. You know, that's a theme of American business today. And what the Chinese restaurateurs were doing was essentially to adapt their cuisine to a different culture's tastes. So you come up with a version of that original food that's not really original in the sense of it being, and you know, we use that word authentic, that doesn't really mean anything.
Right.
It's authentic Chinese American food, but it was meant for a palate that was not used to the more complex version of Chinese food. So
right.
They created versions of, and you talk about, you know, the egg roll, and you know, there's all kinds of things that are
right.
That we now look at, of course. In looking back, if you're interested in food, you look at that Chinese food of the 20th century as being pretty dull. You know, the spices are taken out, and anything interesting like, you know, the mushrooms and weird meats and things like that are all out. The only place you can get that is in the true Chinatowns,
right?
You know, or the now there's a wave of more authentic restaurants. You know, if you go to
Flushing or Sunset Park or
California.
Right.
There's a little town south of San Francisco. That's
Daly City. Down by the airport there.
Lots of Hong Kong seafood restaurants, big, you know, really Taiwanese restaurants. You know, it's much different now. But, you know, and when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, what Chinese food was then was a fairly homogenized version of what Chinese food
was. They discovered back in the 1890s, that if they adapted Chinese food to American taste, they could make a good living at it. And their formula is, in many ways, is like rigid as McDonald's. This is kind of like franchise restaurants without the franchise. And that idea of adapting their cuisine to our taste continues right through to today. If you go to, there are over 40,000 Chinese restaurants in the United States. But the great vast majority of them serve a very limited menu of things like General Tso's chicken, orange beef, chicken with broccoli, fried rice, fried chicken, things like that. And this is all to our taste, not to Chinese taste. Most of the customers in those restaurants are not Chinese at all because they won't eat that stuff. It's not their food. And that's, you know, that's what the sort of recent history of Chinese food in the United States has been.
So looking at it from the perspective of history, which you've given in the book, and I think it is accurate to say it's a cultural history. You know, this is not just, you don't write strictly about the food. This is mainly about the relationship between American culture and Chinese culture played out through the lens of food. So, but if you're just looking at the food and seeing how today many more Chinese people have come to America, the relationship between China and the rest of the world is very different than it was 20, 30, 50. I will have to talk about Nixon because that's really also an important point. But how would you look forward to what's going to happen? I mean, do you have a sense that Chinese food in America will become more interesting and broad as it spreads throughout the country where perhaps the American palate can be more broadened, or is it going to just be this way? What do you think it'll be?
Well, it's very hard to predict, and I didn't try to do that in my book because, you know, it's a historical book rather than a soothsaying book. I can't really tell what's going to happen to American taste in general en masse, but I would guess, just based on the past, that we're still going to have pretty conservative taste. And the Chinese food isn't that most Americans, the food that most Americans are going to eat and like as Chinese food is going to be primarily adapted to their tastes. It's not going to be Chinese food like a Chinese person would order.
So that if you want Chinese food that like a Chinese person would order, which I do, you end up going to a restaurant like in Chinatown in New York where mostly Chinese people are eating. The menu is in Chinese, and you have to convince them that you really are interested in
exactly
the food that they serve.
But you know, there's a lot of Chinatowns in the United States now, and there are a lot of new immigrants, And they're coming from very different parts of China now. And they're opening restaurants to serve their own countrymen. And, for instance, in Flushing here in New York, one of New York's Chinatowns, you can get food from Qingdao, which is the port city where the beer comes from Dongbei, which is the region of northeast China nearest to Siberia and Korea, and also some from Xi'an, the city of the famous terracotta warriors. And the foods they serve is really like exciting and different and really, really good. And hopefully these kind of restaurants will spread and the kind of the seasonings and the dishes and some of the flavor combinations will spread. And we'll be able to have like a greater variety of Chinese food.
I think that's probably right. That makes sense.
Right. But at the same time, as it spreads, it is going to be adapted to American tastes. I mean, I think that's a kind of an inevitable process. And the only hope is, of course, is, I mean, I think it's Chinese food is always related to immigration. And we all, so to keep Chinese food good in this country, we have to keep the door open so new generations of chefs can come from China and open restaurants.
No, I think that's a good point. And that takes us back. I do want to talk about Nixon in China, because that I thought was a very powerful part of the book, for people, a lot of people probably don't know about that because it took place so long ago. Nixon went to China in 1972, and that was really the first opening between the American culture and Chinese culture since Mao took over in 1949, and we had made them the evil enemy. And so you have this great scene of Nixon being trained in advance and all of these people, all of his handlers trying to make sure that they didn't screw it up. But that image of Nixon eating with, and Pat Nixon with him eating with chopsticks was probably a formative moment for a lot of Americans.
Right. I'll give it a little bit of background to the trip. A couple of things happened that made the current sort of culinary world that we live in possible, at least as far as Chinese food. Just a couple of years before Nixon's trip, in 1965, Lyndon Johnson passed the Immigration and Nationality Act, which opened the door to Chinese immigration for the first time since the 1880s. This meant that new Chinese chefs could come to the United States and open restaurants. At that time, of course, there were no relations with China, so that meant Chinese chefs meant from Taiwan, from Hong Kong, and from Southeast Asia. And they did it. They came and they opened a couple of restaurants, including a few Sichuan and Hunan restaurants in places like New York and San Francisco. Then in 1972, Nixon went to China. And he was determined to open relations with China because he wanted to counter the Soviet Union, because he wanted to try to find a way to get out of the Vietnam War, and he wanted to win re-election. But to show the Chinese that he was indeed serious, he decided that he had to eat Chinese food. And this was something which no American president had ever done, at least while he was president. An American president ate Western food with a fork. But Nixon was determined to change things, to show that he was a kind of a sophisticated man of the world. So on Air Force One, on the way to China, he was actually practicing with chopsticks. And the first night that he arrived, they served him a huge banquet in the Great Hall of the People, which was broadcast live around the world. And that would have been at breakfast time the next day in the United States. And he was shown eating things like Peking duck, and like other dishes which Americans had probably never heard of. This was at a time when, they were sort of suddenly, China had been closed off to them for 20 years. They were intensely curious about China, and they became intensely curious about Chinese food. So when they saw Nixon eating this Chinese food, this unfamiliar Chinese food, they said, "We want some of that." That meant going to Chinese restaurants and not ordering chop suey and chow mein and not eating with a fork. But there were only a few Chinese restaurants around serving that kind of food, and it turned out to be the Sichuan and Hunan restaurants that had opened a couple of years earlier. And they started, Americans flocked to them, particularly in places like New York and Washington and San Francisco. And this sparked a culinary revolution. And it sort of introduced Americans to a whole new palette of flavors. It introduced Americans to spicy food and like strongly flavored Chinese food. And that's when things like General Tso's chicken and Kung Pao shrimp really burst on the scene. And that's the kind of the world, that's the Chinese food world that we live in today.
Right, and it kind of coincides probably with the rise of the baby boom generation being able to, thinking of itself as being sophisticated, worldly, eating at different kinds of restaurants and kind of broadening the spectrum of food in America, which has really happened. And it is kind of bizarrely interesting to think of Nixon as the key point or the key moment for that to occur, because the baby boom generation particularly may find Nixon to be not right. The most engaging persona.
If they knew one thing about Nixon is that he loved cottage cheese.
That's right.
Spicy food was sort of attached to, the counterculture. It was like an act of rebellion to eat a chili pepper.
Right, which is a great thing.
Right.
Listen, this is a wonderful book. I really enjoyed reading Chop Suey, and I really enjoyed talking to you today. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Andrew Koh, the author of Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States, published by Oxford University Press and available in hardcover today. Thanks so much, Andrew.
You're welcome, David.